Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Happy Wednesday, everyone. You're listening to All About Healing. I'm your host, Emily Francis, and we have the fabulous producer, Jay, on the line with us. He is what makes this show go round. So thank you, Jay, for all that you do. So I am coming to you from my beautiful home in Malta, beautiful sunny Malta, though it's been raining quite a bit as of late. My olive trees are rejoicing, I have to say. There's a lot of farmers that feel very blessed right now with all the rain that has come in. Quick plug for me, The Taste of Joy, Mediterranean Wisdom for a Life Worth Savoring is out now through the United States and releases February 8th on all of Europe and Malta. So get your copy, get it. All right, without further ado, we're jumping into a subject that I find fascinating and also terrifying. We have an anesthesiologist on the line with us. We have Dr. James E. Cottrell. And he is the author of the new book, Anesthesia Without Fear, The Informed Consumer's Guide to Safe Surgery and Chronic Pain Relief. Dr. Cottrell, thank you for being here, and welcome to All About Healing.
Thank you very much, Emily. I'm in New York City, and we haven't had snow this winter yet, so we're lucky.
You haven't had any snow?
No, none. Not in New York City. So, and the flowers are coming up in the backyard.
Oh, that's a little. My friend lives in Boston, and she's got feet and feet of snow.
Oh, I know, but you don't want to go to Boston. It's too
cold.
That's
crazy. Well, she just moved from her. Like, she's born and raised in Malta, and just left and moved to the United States. And she's like, it's our first snow, and it's really big, and she's really excited. That's really crazy. I didn't realize New York hadn't had any snow yet. The climate around the world is crazy. New York City has not had any snow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Okay, so let's jump in because I have a lot of questions. So I want to start with the really basic thing for anybody who's always curious about this but never necessarily have thought about it. Tell me, what are the requirements, the med school years and all the things you have to do to become an anesthesiologist? Let's start there.
Well, you have to have 4 years of undergraduate to get an undergraduate degree. Then you go to medical school for 4 years and get your MD, and then you take an internship for a year, and then you go into a residency for 3 years of anesthesia, and then if you're going to subspecialize in cardiac or neuro, then you go for another year in that training. So it's a long time.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I don't think a lot of people realize that an anesthesiologist is also an MD. I know that might sound crazy, but I don't think a lot of people know that.
Well, it sounds crazy to me, but I can understand it because when I went into anesthesia a number of years ago, we had nurses mostly giving anesthesia because there weren't enough doctors to go around. So I think that's where that came from.
Honestly, because when I have had, like, my C-sections, I had both of my babies via C-section, and the anesthesiologist was, like, my lifeline. I mean, I asked them, like, please will you hold my hand? Please don't leave the room. Like, I needed to know that they were going to be there because, to
right.
me, that's the big one, you know,
right.
is,
we
like,
keep you,
how safe.
Right. We keep you alive while surgeons do things that would otherwise kill you.
It is really deep, and I have to say, now here's a question that I have, and this is just as a parent. I took both of my children to get a DNA swab it's called an alpha genomics test, and it tells you what you can handle and what you cannot in anesthesia and in medication. And I remember my daughter had to be put under for a really extensive dental work or for an MRI. I can't remember. And the anesthesiologist was shocked by this test results that I had, because I came in with this big notebook and I said, look, here's the ones you can use with her. Here's the ones I don't want you to touch. And he said, oh, my gosh, I've never seen anything like this. If I cover up her name, may I make copies of this? Because parents really should know this stuff. So I want to know, because from a parent's perspective, a lot of people don't find out they have a morphine allergy until they're receiving it and their tongue swells and then they have to go through something. So before we even talk about ill effects or reactions to anesthesia, do you find that, are you familiar with the alpha genome test, or do you find that people nowadays do know what they can and cannot tolerate?
Well, I am familiar with it, but I think you're cutting edge, and it's not well known by anesthesiologists or surgeons or patients even. So that would be a whole new topic for you to do on your radio show.
Well, that's why I just opened it up with you, because
right.
Who else would I talk about that to?
Right.
But I do remember, because I had it done. I have two children, and I have two stepchildren, and I had those tests done on all four kids. Because
right.
I don't want to be someplace and something happen when I could have prevented it. And it's a simple mouth swab. But I have to say, at the time, my husband worked for one of the biggest tech companies in the world and had literally the best insurance on the planet. So we were able to get that, and we went to a pediatric geneticist to get it done. But I do think that it saved us, because now we know that we are really sensitive to morphine, so stick with the propofol or one of those.
Right.
And that's important, because these are my babies, you know. Now I would have done that test at the time. Sorry?
Yeah. What did you say?
You said something, and I cut in.
No.
Okay. So I do want to talk about morphine. This is just because I've had a lot of friends that had found out that they have a morphine allergy once they had it administered, and then their tongue would swell. Do you find that morphine is a common sensitive one to give?
No, I don't. In fact, I don't think I've ever had a reaction to morphine given intravenously. The main reaction to morphine, of course, is nausea and vomiting, and that's what we try to prevent during anesthesia and surgery. But I think the morphine allergy is sort of rare, really rare. I haven't seen it in my 40 years of practice. I haven't seen a morphine allergy.
My best friend has one and didn't know until her tongue swelled, and they were trying to do some gastric stuff with her, and her tongue swelled, and that's how she found out that she had a morphine allergy. So in my head, it just meant it's probably really common. But really, I didn't realize that it is not common.
No, antibiotics that we give intravenously, it's common to have allergies to those and some of the vasoreactive drugs, but not morphine in my practice.
Now, I'm going to have a colonoscopy coming up soon, and I think they're going to use propofol. Is that a really common anesthesia that's now being used?
Well, there are four types of anesthesia for different procedures, and for a colonoscopy, you'll have conscious sedation. So that means you'll be arousable if we would like you to be. So you don't lose consciousness. And we can do that conscious sedation with midazolam and a narcotic. Midazolam is a benzodiazepine like Valium, and a narcotic. Or we can do it with propofol, or we can do it with a newer drug, which may have some advantages, dexmedetomidine. And all of those can give you conscious sedation, so you can have your colonoscopy without pain or without anxiety.
This is very fascinating to me. So there's really only four kinds of anesthesia. Is that what you said?
That's what I said. There's general anesthesia. There's local anesthesia. There's spinal anesthesia. And there's conscious sedation. Spinal is a regional anesthetic.
Conscious sedation, is that what's considered twilight sleep?
Well, I think that gives it a bad name if you call it through your colonoscopy twilight sleep. But that's sort of what when a dentist does your dental work, sometimes uses nitrous oxide and lets you breathe 50%, and that can be called twilight sleep. But that I think we have to stay away from, because that's usually done in a dentist office many times without an anesthesiologist. So you don't really want to have twilight sleep for your colonoscopy.
How fascinating. My mom always has called it twilight sleep. So, because I asked the doctor that. I said, don't I just get to do twilight? And he said, no, I think we should put you all the way under. And I thought, well, why? And he said, we'll do propofol.
Well, it's really conscious sedation, so I don't think he's putting you all the way under, because if he wanted to, he could ask you a question and get you to respond.
Okay, that is fascinating to me. How hard is that? Is that just like a lighter dose to get somebody to wake up and answer?
Right. You give a slow infusion of the drug through an infusion pump at a low dose, and you have to determine on each patient how much is a low dose, because if you give too much, then, of course, you've got another problem. You could lose the respiration in the patient.
Let's start with, what does an anesthesiologist do before surgery? And what I mean by that is a two-part question. First, I want to know the conversation that you have directly with the patient. And then I want to know what you do to prepare for the surgery. Is that fair? Can I ask both?
Sure. Well, we're often referred to as the unknown doctor, because we go into the operating room and meet the patient for the first time and review the chart that the nurse has completed before they come to the operating room. And then, of course, they go afterwards to the recovery room, and nurses are taking care of the patient there as well. But I'm trying to get away from that, because that's my biggest nightmare. I think the patient needs to ask to speak with the anesthesiologist, and then there are two critical things that the patient needs to obtain from that conversation with the anesthesiologist. The first is what all of her medical or his medical history, what drugs they take, what surgeries they've had, what diseases they've had, and give them all of the information that will help the anesthesiologist take care of them in the best way. And then you ask the anesthesiologist, what can you offer me for this particular kind of procedure? As you said, if it's a colonoscopy, then you'd know it was conscious sedation. If it were a hip replacement or a knee replacement, then you would want a regional anesthetic, and you'd need to discuss that with the anesthesiologist and say, what are the complications and what can I do to avoid complications from this anesthetic, or is there a better anesthetic for me? So those are the two things you need. You need to give information, and you need to obtain information from the anesthesiologist. And then I'll take that information back with me, and if someone has hypertension, then I would use a specific anesthetic drug. If someone has asthma, I would use a specific technique or drug. So I would then tailor my anesthetic plan to the discussion I've had with the patient.
Wow. Okay. Now I have to ask this question. You probably get it all the time, but I have to ask, what do you do if you've administered the anesthesia and then find out that they are allergic or having a poor reaction to it?
Well, we are equipped to handle all kinds of emergencies. That's why we're anesthesiologists. And so we have a cart of drugs that are beside us. And if we have an anaphylactic reaction, then we give a drug, epinephrine, to counteract that. If we simply have a hive or a redness in the skin, then we can give Benadryl, which is an antihistamine. And then many times we give both, the epinephrine as well as the Benadryl, if it's a severe reaction.
That's always my biggest fear, to be honest, is that somehow my body is not going to be compatible, because I don't know anything about these medicines. I mean, like I said, I had those tests done for my children, and I would basically probably show an anesthesiologist them, because they come from me, so I probably have similar sensitivities, I would guess. But the truth is, except for the word propofol or morphine, I don't know any other medicine that might be administered. But there's a whole gamut of them, right?
Oh, yeah, and they're all outlined in my book with the different kinds of anesthesia that's available.
And a patient doesn't really have the... They can discuss it with the anesthesiologist, but at the end of the day, you're the one that really knows the medicine, so you can do a good... Even though you have a quick conversation with these patients, have you ever, I'm sure you have, but have you ever looked at the chart that the nurse took and then talked to the patient and realized that it didn't line up with your instincts or what you thought?
Oh, of course. That happens. That's why we have a number of people look at the patient. We have the, you know, the pre-admission testing nurse. We have the usually a nurse practitioner or a nurse anesthetist do a pre-op, and then the anesthesiologist sees the patient and does a pre-op.
Okay.
And the sicker the patient is, the more likely you are to get the anesthesiologist.
Okay. What are there any? Obviously, contraindications, but what kind of people fall under the category that anesthesia is not, they're not a candidate?
Well, the extremes of age we're very concerned about, because there's been a lot of recent studies, well, I guess the last 10 or 15 years, that indicate in the elderly over 65 years of age who have inhalation anesthesia, they develop delirium post-op, and then they develop cognitive function, which may or may not, cognitive dysfunction, which may or may not be permanent. And then if we look at young children less than 2 years of age, they also can develop, if they get an anesthetic for greater than 2 hours at a higher concentration, they can in the future develop behavioral problems and memory problems as well. So we have to be very careful with the extremes of age.
You know, I always think about that with animals, because as the animals get older, we really want to avoid surgery at all costs if we can, because they
right.
have such a hard time coming back out. But I don't think I had realized that you could really have cognitive dysfunction following too long under anesthetic. That's terrifying.
Yeah, that's in the elderly and the very young. And it's usually about 30% of the people who get it. And then it's another 10 or 15% that it becomes permanent.
So, like,
and
for somebody like
it,
myself, go ahead.
A lot of it has to do with the pre-op existing cognitive impairment. If you have mild cognitive impairment pre-anesthesia, then you'll probably get it post-anesthesia, and it may be worsened.
For a baby that's being born and the mother has had to go under for anesthesia, how dangerous is it to the fetus, to the baby?
Well, there's no danger if you use regional anesthesia. And that's what, you know, every pregnant lady who comes into our hospital always asks for an epidural or a spinal. They really don't want to have a general anesthetic. So if you have a regional anesthetic that prevents the drugs that you might use intravenously or inhalationally from going into the baby or the fetus and depressing the fetus.
Really? So I had a spinal block, and you're telling me that it didn't actually affect my babes?
No.
Wow.
Epidural wouldn't either.
I had no idea. Wow. That's...
Well, unless you...
I don't think people know that.
I think a lot of people know it, because all the people that I see who are, all the women I see who are pregnant want a regional, and it's an epidural or a spinal. And also they can be awake to greet their baby when the baby comes.
Yeah, I was awake, and I knew it was regional, but I still assumed it would get in the bloodstream and travel to the baby. I knew it was going to be a regional area of pain numbing for me, but I didn't realize that it actually blocked transmitting to the baby. I didn't know that.
No, it doesn't actually cross enough to the baby to hurt it.
That makes me feel much better, to tell you the truth, because as you just said, you know, under age two, how dangerous that is, then all of a sudden in my head I'm thinking, was this my fault? You know, all of a sudden you start having these fears of what that does, because the whole thing is scary. Now, let's go to the holistic side, the part that I love, and that is on the recovery ends, I always, the couple of times that my children have had to have something, any kind of numbing, I stick them in an Epsom salt and sea salt bath to help pull some of the stuff. But what are some of your go-tos that you would recommend to someone in your family who has just had anesthesia?
To recover from the anesthesia?
Yes. To help get it out of your body the best it can.
Well, I think drinking fluid is a good idea, and water's fine, but not if you have congestive heart failure or renal failure, because then the water would stay in your body. But you need to wash your body out of the drugs that are circulating, and by drinking extra water, that'll help do that.
Okay, so as long as they don't have fluid retention issues.
Right.
Because I'm a lymphedema therapist. You know what, I'm sure you know what lymphedema is. But that's my specialty training is working on lymphedema. So the fluid retention is chronic. And so that's a tough place to be, because you may not have congestive heart or renal issues, but you have congestive, you know, chronic swelling in a limb. And
right.
So that makes it really hard to get that stuff out. Because I do think when I've had anesthesia, it tastes like metal in my mouth. It's very strong, and I'm super sensitive to it. What's the best way? So I always jump in that salt bath, like I said, but what are some of the tricks of the trade? Because how long does the anesthesia stay in your body?
Well, it varies with the anesthetic. Some anesthetics are gone in 4 minutes or 5 minutes. Other anesthetics can linger for hours. The inhalation anesthetics, particularly, some of them can linger for hours. But the intravenous anesthetics are usually very short-acting, and that's why we use them, particularly for conscious sedation.
Okay, I have a lot more questions on that, but we got to take a quick commercial break. But don't worry, everybody. We are going to keep Dr. Cottrell on the line, and we'll be right back.
Emily A. Francis's new book, The Taste of Joy, Mediterranean Wisdom for a Life Worth Savoring, is all about heartfelt hints on attaining the most healthiest, fun, and inspiring life. By adding a bit of the Mediterranean lifestyle into your life, you'll explore the wisdom of eating mindfully, seasonally, and locally, as well as discover Mediterranean family secrets to health and happiness. And it's all in The Taste of Joy. Get your copy today at Amazon.com or visit EmilyAFrancisBooks.com.
Now there's hope for authentic healing. A new book by Emily A. Francis, Whole Body Healing, Create Your Own Path to Physical, Emotional, Energetic, and Spiritual Wellness, can help you discover a deeper way to approach your healing instead of using just the usual mainstream medical single methods. With Whole Body Healing and its extensive background of research, you'll be able to create your own healing path to achieve true and lasting results. Pre-order Whole Body Healing now at Amazon.com. You won't want to miss this priceless information. Whole Body Healing at Amazon.com by Emily A. Francis.
ASMC, the premier German company that supplies everything for adventure, from outdoor clothes to outdoor gear, even backpacks. Lots of quality and lots of specials. To start your adventure, go to HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on ASMC.
You may never totally understand this man-woman emotional connection thing, but now you can understand your muscles' emotional connection in regards to your health. That's right, your muscles have an emotional connection. And if you want an easy-to-use blueprint to understand your muscles' emotion, then get Emily A. Francis's book, The Body Heals Itself. It helps you activate and heal your muscles on an emotional level. So indeed, The Body Heals Itself. Plus, it's filled with tools you can use immediately. Find out more at EmilyAFrancisBooks.com. Buy The Body Heals Itself now.
When you need a positive point of view, turn to HealthyLife.net, your 24/7 radio network for a better future.
Well, Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to All About Healing. If you're just tuning in or you're tuning in for the first time, I am Emily Francis. I'm your host, and I welcome you to return and follow along as we interview these amazing, amazing doctors and other healthcare practitioners on your health and healing. Today, we have Dr. James E. Cottrell, and that's C-O-T-T-R-E-L-L, M.D., and he is the author of the book, Anesthesia Without Fear, The Informed Consumer's Guide to Safe Surgery and Chronic Pain Relief. Dr. Cottrell, where can people buy your book?
You can buy it online through Amazon. And there is a website called anesthesiawithoutfear.com, which gives you more information about myself and some of the other anesthetic procedures.
You know, I think this is a fascinating conversation and topic, and I don't think very many people, if ever, have done something like you did to put a book out there. What did prompt you to write this book?
Well, as I said, it was going to the operating room in the morning and seeing patients and say, I'd introduce myself and say, I'm your anesthesiologist, and what questions do you have for me? And they would say, Doc, I don't want to know anything, just put me out. And that's not the right way to go about saving your life and getting the best to the results from your anesthesia and surgery. You really need to know what's available, particularly with your health conditions.
I fully agree with this. I think it is vitally important that knowledge is power and knowledge is the key. And if you are going to go under, you should know what's happening. I ask a lot of questions. I definitely want to know what's being administered. I like to know that I'm in safe hands, that's never going to stop watching and monitoring me.
Right.
Because there are stories, like people, there's like crazy stories of nutty things happening while people are in surgery. And even my friend, my personal friend, who's a radiologist herself, the doctor left a surgical sponge inside her breast during a lumpectomy. And
right.
He kept going back to the doctor saying, I have an issue, this hurts, this something's wrong. And he kept saying, no, you're just recovering. And she finally went back and she said, what did I tell you I do for a living? What did I say? That's radiology 101. You left a surgical sponge inside my body. Like, are you, you're really just watching the anesthesia, right? You don't really have time to watch another part of the surgery, if I'm correct. But what really goes on in those settings?
Well, we work as a team, so we have lots of eyes on everything that's happening. And the nurses, the scrub nurses, the anesthesiologists, everyone's watching. And if they see something abnormal, they'll of course, raise the question. But I think with the anesthesiologist, you have to ask when he or she is interviewing you, you have to ask, who will be doing my anesthesia? And will you, and if he says yes, then you say, will you be present throughout my procedure? And if you do leave, who will you leave in charge of my anesthesia? And then you can say, I don't want you to leave. So I think it's very important to ask the anesthesiologist to stay with you during the procedure.
And if we did ask, does that mean usually we would get our way and they would stay?
Yes, I think it would be really highly unethical if they didn't.
That's good to know. That's really good to know.
Yeah.
Now, I do want to talk about, you mentioned that some anesthesia gets out in a couple of minutes, and then some, especially inhalation, can stay in. But yet, if you're under anesthesia for a long enough time, you can have serious damage to the body and to the brain. Let's take this a step further and talk about how quickly people can become addicted. Can we dive into that?
Well, anesthesiologists that are they have a high number of drug addicts because the drugs are right there in front of you and they're available and you can use them and you get addicted and then you overdose. So the addiction possibility for anesthesiologists is pretty great. Also, if you're a patient and you have chronic pain syndrome, then you can go from one doctor to another getting narcotics, and eventually you'll probably become a narcotic addict. But there's so many other things that we can do to prevent that if you go to the right doctor who's pain certified, you don't have to become an addict, and you can use other things other than narcotics to control the pain.
So what if somebody is already an addict and they're sober, and then they have to go for surgery? All right, so you would do a completely different application of the medication? Would that be? Okay.
Yes. How did you know that? If we have an addict that comes in who's been in recovery and has been abstinent, then we don't give them narcotics to reintroduce their addiction. So in that case, we would use an inhalation anesthetic.
And that's not addictive?
No, it's not addictive.
I find that fascinating because if I were an addict, I think I might like inhalation type of high. I mean, I don't know, but I guess, because you can't get your hands on it or because it's a totally different substance?
Well, you can't get your hands on it, and then we've had some addiction in the operating room where the doctors and nurses go in and do twilight sleep with nitrous oxide. So that's pretty, but that's fun. That's not really addictive.
And then you don't give them narcotics as a prescription following the actual procedure. Is that true?
Well, I think we used to go and have procedures, and the surgeon who was operating would give you 30 days of oxycodone. And, you know, then you'd take them for 30 days, and, of course, you'd want them for another 30 days. So now most people leave with three days of narcotics and then other things to make up for the pain. And that's, you know, like activity, exercise, neuroleptics, sedatives, anti-convulsives, and a lot of different other drugs that aren't narcotics that can help you recover. And even acupuncture.
Oh, I love acupuncture. I love, mm-hmm. love. Do you ever work with an acupuncturist in the same, like, surgery or post-op?
Well, in my early days, I went to China to observe acupuncture being used for anesthesia. And it was very effective for not painful surgical procedures like labor and delivery. But for open, like, craniotomies, it wasn't effective enough to do the craniotomy. So I have seen acupuncture used for all kinds of procedures, but it's mostly for the minor, painful procedures that it's effective.
So I have another, as like a medical practitioner, you have like a specialty. But as an anesthesiologist, it would seem to me that you sit in for all different types of surgeries. Do you have a particular thing that you tend, like, do you work with knee replacements all the time, or do you work with everything?
Well, I'm a neuroanesthesiologist, so I only work with brain tumors and spinal injuries and traumatic brain injuries. But there are subspecialties. There are six or eight subspecialties. We have a cardiac, we have neuro, we have pediatrics, we have critical care, and we have pain management. We have a lot of subspecialties. And you should ask for that. If you have a child and you're having a pediatric procedure, then you ask for a pediatric anesthesiologist. And the same if you're having cardiac surgery, you ask for a cardiac anesthesiologist. Or a transplant, God forbid, then you'd ask for a transplant anesthesiologist.
I have more questions on this exact subject, but we've got to take a quick commercial break. But I'm going to pick right up in this conversation. So everybody who's listening, don't go away. We'll be right back.
Trauma or joy, shame or happiness, guilt or empowerment. Let Emily's new book, Healing Ourselves Whole, be the bridge to help you release negative emotions to help you heal on every level to create more joy, more health, and more vitality. Our body knows what we might forget. It's time to rearrange your inner conversation into spectacular health and happiness, and Healing Ourselves Whole is your step-by-step guide. Find out more at emilyafrancisbooks.com and buy Healing Ourselves Whole at Amazon.com now.
Now there's hope for authentic healing. A new book by Emily A. Franz's Whole Body Healing, Create Your Own Path to Physical, Emotional, Energetic, and Spiritual Wellness can help you discover a deeper way to approach your healing instead of using just the usual mainstream medical single methods. With Whole Body Healing and its extensive background of research, you'll be able to create your own healing path to achieve true and lasting results. Pre-order Whole Body Healing now at Amazon.com. You won't want to miss this priceless information. Whole Body Healing at Amazon.com by Emily A. Francis.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
You may never totally understand this man-woman emotional connection thing, but now you can understand your muscles' emotional connection in regards to your health. That's right, your muscles have an emotional connection. And if you want an easy-to-use blueprint to understand your muscles' emotion, then get Emily A. Francis's book, The Body Heals Itself. It helps you activate and heal your muscles on an emotional level. So indeed, The Body Heals Itself. Plus, it's filled with tools you can use immediately. Find out more at EmilyAFrancisBooks.com. Buy The Body Heals Itself now.
The Bright Side of Talk, HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to All About Healing. I'm your host, Emily Francis. Today we have Dr. James E. Cottrell, M.D. He is the author of Anesthesia Without Fear, The Informed Consumer's Guide to Safe Surgery and Chronic Pain Relief. We were just talking about subspecialties of anesthesiologists and that you are a neuroanesthesiologist. And right before the break, so that I don't lose my train of thought, you mentioned, let's say you're getting something cardiac or you're getting something pediatric, you want to specifically ask for a pediatric anesthesiologist or a cardiac anesthesiologist. Do we need to ask for that? Is that something that really that isn't already put in place?
Generally, hospitals have cardiac anesthesia teams or neuroanesthesia teams, but sometimes they, especially if it's an emergency, those people won't be available. And also, they have some general anesthesiologists that can do cardiac or pediatrics or obstetrics. And so they're placed in those rooms during the day unless someone actually asks for a specific kind of anesthesiologist.
So if we were in, if we or someone we know or love is in an emergency situation, an emergency is different, could we still make sure that we ask, or should we? Would you advise that we still ask, even if it is?
I would ask if there's one available, and if there is, if he or she has time to get in. If there's none available, ask if this person's done this procedure before. And if they say no, there's usually two people on call in the operating room. So then you could ask for the other anesthesiologist and see if that person has done these procedures before.
Is that in your book?
I think it is. We had a transplant team for liver transplants, and we had one transplant anesthesiologist, and then all of a sudden we got a liver transplant, and we had to call a hospital nearby to send over one of their transplant anesthesiologists, and we got them, so it was really great.
I think that's one of the most important key takeaways that we have done in any show, but especially in this show. Because never would it cross my mind to specifically ask for a particular type of anesthesiologist, because I would make the assumption, which is a terrible place to be, that I would get the right anesthesiologist for what I'm going through or for what somebody in the hospital that's with me is going through. It would never, ever cross my mind to specifically ask, is this what you're trained? If not, can we get an anesthesiologist that is trained in this? How many do you have on staff right now who can do this? That's a huge,
right. That's
a power move, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that it takes the power back into our own hands as the patient to have some say in what's going on and who's going to be entering the space with us. That's huge. What
right.
Are there other little things like that? Little things that, that people that do not have any idea what they're doing in these places, what are the main takeaways that somebody should do?
Another takeaway would be if you're having one of those cardiac or complicated pediatric procedures, you ask if they have a cardiothoracic ICU or if they have a neonatal ICU or a pediatric ICU and who runs them. Is it an anesthesiologist? Is it a pediatrician? And will they be there for the care postoperatively if it's needed?
So for an outpatient, something as easy as the colonoscopy that I'm going to be doing, do I bother to ask these questions, or do I just say, hey, it's just general, it's not a big deal?
No, I think this training for colonoscopies occurs in the first 3 years of anesthesia. But if you're having
so
a subspecialist, if you have a subspecialist, then they do an extra year in that subspecialty.
So what made you decide to go into neuro, and how long have you been doing neuro, or did you do another kind before that?
No, I decided, I was drafted for Vietnam way back when there was a draft. And so Vietnam was winding down, so I was placed at the Philadelphia Naval Hospital. And the commander on base asked me if I would do all the traumatic brain injuries that came to the hospital. And I said, sure, why not? So I did, and I had a good time. And so then I was recruited to NYU, New York University, and the chairman of anesthesia asked if I could head the neuro section. And I sort of learned my neuro just by doing and running the neuro ICU. We had a great ICU, and we had a lot of great neurosurgeons and internists and hematologists. We had a real team that we put together. So I just became a neuroanesthesiologist and then wrote the first book on neuroanesthesia in the journal, editor of the journal. So that's how I became a neuroanesthesiologist. But now you do an extra year of training in neuro.
When you were drafted for Vietnam, were you already a medical professional, or like what capacity did you know?
I was deferred until I got my MD degree, and then they found out I was going to go into anesthesia, and they deferred me again because they said more people were dying from the anesthesia than they were from the injuries. So they deferred me until I finished my residency then.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a heck of a story in and of itself. Is any of that in the book?
I don't know. I'll have to reread it.
That's a fascinating way to get into this practice. I mean, it really just seems like all signs pointed to this is what you're going to do for your life.
Amazing.
This is your calling.
Right. Yeah.
That's amazing. So tell me a little bit more. You wrote the book on before this book. You wrote in the journal, and I want to make sure I say it right. You were the former president of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. So
yes.
That's a huge accolade. And so it makes sense that you were the one to write this particular book. But you said you also wrote in the journal, I'm assuming you've been published many, many times. Can you give me a little background?
Well, I think I was at NYU for 5 years, and we had a lot of studies and it made a lot of advances in anesthesia. And then I was recruited to Downstate in Brooklyn, SUNY Brooklyn. And also there I was able to do a lot of laboratory research and work on memory and consciousness and things like that. So then I published more in that area, and also the effects of anesthetic drugs on the brain. So it sort of crosses over all the subspecialties when I look at the effects of anesthetics on the brain and memory and delirium and unconsciousness. And so it's a very interesting subject to study.
As a fellow author, but not nearly to the level and degree that you are, I do know that I have certain books or certain works, certain specialties in my own history that are my babies. That are the things that I definitely want associated with my work, with my name, with my research. What if you were talking to a fellow anesthesiologist or somebody in the field, what would be the thing, what would be some of the research that you were part of that you are most most proud of?
Well, I think that we really don't know how anesthetics work, and we don't know how much anesthesia is enough, and we use a monitor to try to tell us so that we won't get patients too deep, because that's not a good thing. So we need to study the brain and the effects of anesthetics more and how they work, and also to prevent behavioral and cognitive abnormalities from occurring with these anesthetic drugs. Because it's not without likelihood that something could happen to your brain while you're having anesthesia. So, you know, we can save the patient now. We used to have lots of mortality from anesthesia way back, in the 70s and 80s. But now there's hardly any mortality. So now we have to work on morbidity, which would be cognitive dysfunction and personality changes and those sorts of things that are due to the anesthetic administration.
I have more questions on that. We got to take our last commercial break of the show. We're going to keep Dr. Cottrell on with us. Emily's Energy Corner is coming right into this subject because it's too fascinating and too powerful to let go of too early. So don't go away, everybody. We'll be right back.
Emily A. Francis's new book, The Taste of Joy, Mediterranean Wisdom for a Life Worth Savoring, is all about heartfelt hints on attaining the most healthiest, fun, and inspiring life. By adding a bit of the Mediterranean lifestyle into your life, you'll explore the wisdom of eating mindfully, seasonally, and locally, as well as discover Mediterranean family secrets to health and happiness. And it's all in The Taste of Joy. Get your copy today at Amazon.com or visit EmilyAFrancisBooks.com.
Now there's hope for authentic healing. A new book by Emily A. Francis, Whole Body Healing, Create Your Own Path to Physical, Emotional, Energetic, and Spiritual Wellness, can help you discover a deeper way to approach your healing instead of using just the usual mainstream medical single methods. With Whole Body Healing and its extensive background of research, you'll be able to create your own healing path to achieve true and lasting results. Pre-order Whole Body Healing now at Amazon.com. You won't want to miss this priceless information. Whole Body Healing at Amazon.com by Emily A. Francis.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
If you have low vision or are blind, then listen up. There's now high visibility trendy sports clothing available just for you. At AwareWolfGear.com, you'll find attractive, stretchy, warm hoodies, headgear, leggings, even kids' wear to fit the duality of blindness, the need to be seen without drawing needless attention. Check out these trendy clothes for yourself or for someone you know at AwareWolfGear.com. That's AwareWolfGear.com. AwareWolfGear.com.
Music, information, and friends. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back, everyone. It's usually time for Emily's Energy Corner, but honestly, I don't want to talk that much except for to ask questions. So we have Dr. James E. Cottrell on the line. He is the author of the book, Anesthesia Without Fear. Please go to anesthesiawithoutfear.com. You can also go to your online retailers and order this book. I believe everyone should have a copy of this book. Every person in their life, if they're lucky, will wind up in the hospital for something. You know, that's just, hopefully you've been alive long enough and will be alive long enough. It's something wonderful. Hopefully you're there to, you know, give birth or visit or, you know, hopefully it's wonderful things. But either way, everybody usually will wind up in some part of their life needing to know about anesthesia. So one of the things that you just talked about is that the need for research on the brain. And with the research that has been done to this point, what are some of the things as the patient that we can do, knowing that we're going to go into surgery, what can we do on our own, on our part, to protect that brain as best we can following anesthesia?
Well, I think that's when you have to use your pre-op visit with the anesthesiologist to discuss what he or she's going to use after you've told them what your medical condition is. And you know that the inhalation anesthetics are not good for your brain. It's like fetal alcohol syndrome. You know what happens to babies when the mother drinks a lot? Well, that's sort of what happens when inhalation anesthetics cross the placenta, and we can have some damage there as well, and it crosses the blood-brain barrier and goes to the brain. So we need to really take steps and learn exactly what is the best anesthetics that won't cause harm, do no harm, but yet induce a state of unconsciousness.
Wow. And as far as the research, are you currently working on some research now?
Yes, we're working on epigenetics and the influence of anesthetics on epigenetics and what might happen to offspring if their mothers have had anesthesia, and then if it's passed on down through generations. We're also looking at memory and converting short-term memory to long-term memory. And in our lab, there's an investigator named Todd Sachter that's discovered an enzyme. It's called PKM-zeta that converts short-term memory to long-term memory. And so we're trying to find out how that works with anesthetics and how it works with Alzheimer's and how it works with anesthetics and Alzheimer's. So there's wonderful research going on in that area, and we're lucky to be able to be doing it. We also have a brain bank where we can get brains to study people who've had autism and try to find out some of the other causes of autism as well.
Wow. There is a Michael Morgan. Have you ever heard that name?
No.
He's a craniosacral therapist, works in the brain, and has had breakthrough work with preventing Alzheimer's, and also works on the autism spectrum, does a lot of work with craniosacral therapy. Anyway, I thought maybe at some point you guys might cross through. The research is pretty massive. So for the last couple of minutes, I'm going to give you the floor. So anything that you came here to share for any person that's listening, I want to make sure that you are not interrupted with the message you came here to share.
Well, I think it's important that, as I said earlier, that you ask to see your anesthesiologist, that you talk with your anesthesiologist, and it's a two-way street. You give her all the information about your medical condition, and then you ask her what is the best anesthetic for you that won't hurt your medical conditions as they currently exist. I think that's probably one of the most important things. Then, you know, I think you can't delay the treatment of pain, because if you have chronic pain, you have to get that taken care of so that it won't become permanent. And you need to have it treated, and not just by narcotics, but there are dorsal root ganglion stimulators, there are neurostimulators, there are infusion pumps for narcotics that go directly into the area that has the pain. You can use neuroleptics, you can use sedatives, you can use acupuncture, and then, of course, exercise. So you don't have to be an addict if you have pain. And that's probably the second most important thing that you need to remember after reading this book.
I think that is so powerful, so, so powerful. And from the holistic non-medical side, I do hope that people look into this and also look into craniosacral therapy as a part after, because it does work with the cerebral spinal fluid and the brain, and does help. It does help in massive ways for a lot of different situations for recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So, anything else that you want to make sure that people hear from you out of your mouth? Because you know, people that write books have big messages, and I want to just anything that you want to tell them, places to go. Do you teach online? Is there anything that people can contact you?
I think through the website. I'm contactable, so they can just write to the website, and I will get back to them.
That's amazing. And you are still currently in practice, correct?
No, I'm not. I'm doing research now.
Oh, wow. Because if I heard this and I lived in New York, I would go to whatever hospital you were at for any kind of surgery. Like, please take me wherever he is. Okay, so now you're on the research side.
Right. I'm on the research end of it and trying to discover ways to prevent injury to patients from anesthetics as they're administered to them.
You know, that's such a scary thought, because here we are taking these precautions, and hopefully the anesthesiologists are highly trained, as they have to be, but it's still really scary how many things can happen following anesthesia. And as a person who doesn't really understand it, it's just, how can that be? It just, you're under for however long the surgery takes, but the effects seem to be ongoing. Is that
right,
fair?
It's very stressful for the anesthesiologist, I must tell you, because when things start to go wrong, you have to know what to do, what medicine you use to change it and to get the patient through the procedure. So it's very stressful for the anesthesiologist. But it's one of the most intimate relationships that you have, that any physician has with a patient, because their life literally depends on you, because you breathe for them. You keep their blood pressure up, you keep them from being injured otherwise in the operating room. So it's very important.
Okay, now here's my question then, and I mean no disrespect, but for the anesthesiologist to be keeping me alive when I'm under, yet there's such a high level of addiction in the anesthesiologist, that makes me very, very nervous. Is there ever, do you find that these addicts are under the influence during their working hours, or are they usually better about keeping it to the outside? Are there things you should be looking for?
And this happens very quickly, because once you start to use IV narcotics, we have the synthetic narcotics. You've heard about fentanyl now being used on the street and being mixed with drugs and killing young kids. And so once they start using these synthetic narcotics, they're so powerful, 1,000 times more powerful than morphine, then they overdose. So it's not a problem usually for the operating room, because they go so quickly.
Wow. That's something to think about. All right. Yeah. Dr. Cottrell, I hope that you come back to the show. I've had so many things to think about after this conversation. I think you are spectacular. I hope that everybody who's listening goes and gets your book, and I do look forward to bringing you back here very soon. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Everybody,
okay.
You've been listening to
Anytime.
All About Healing. Thank you. And make it a great week.